The gale buffeted the top of the tower, a hot, unpleasant wind that whispered with strange voices and rubbed the skin like fine sandpaper. In the centre of it, Coyne stood with the staff over his head. As dust filled the air, the wizards saw the lines of magic force pouring from it. They curved up to form a vast bubble that expanded until it must have been larger than the city, and shapes appeared in it. They were shifting and indistinct, wavering horribly like visions in a distorting mirror, no more substantial than smoke rings or pictures in the clouds, but they were dreadfully familiar. There, for a moment, was the fanged snout of Offler. There, clear for an instant in the writhing storm, was blind Io, chief of the gods, with his orbiting eyes. Coyne muttered soundlessly, and the bubble began to contract. It bulged and jerked obscenely as the things inside it fought to get out, but they could not stop the contraction. Now it was bigger than the university grounds. Now it was taller than the tower. Now it was twice the height of a man, and smoke grey. Now it was an iridescent pearl, the size of... well, the size of a large pearl. The gale had gone, replaced by a heavy, silent calm. The very air groaned with the strain. Most of the wizards were flat on the floor, pressed there by the unleashed forces that thickened the air and deadened sound like a universe of feathers. But every one of them could hear his own heart beating loud enough to smash the tower.
"Look at me!"
Coyne commanded. They turned their eyes upwards. There was no way they could disobey. He held the glistening thing in one hand. The other held the staff, which had smoke pouring from its ends.
"The gods," he said, "imprisoned in a thought, and perhaps they were never more than a dream."
His voice became older, deeper.
"Wizards of Unseen University," it said, "have I not given you absolute dominion?"
Behind him, the carpet rose slowly over the side of the tower, with Rincewind trying hard to keep his balance. His eyes were wide with the sort of terror that comes naturally to anyone standing on a few threads and several hundred feet of empty air. He lurched off the hovering thing and then onto the tower, swinging the loaded sock around his head in wide, dangerous sweeps. Coyne saw him reflected in the astonished stares of the assembled wizards. He turned carefully and watched the wizards stagger erratically towards him.
"Who are you?" he said.
"I have come," said Rincewind thickly, "to challenge the sorcerer. Which one is he?"
He surveyed the prostrate wizardry, hefting the half-brick in one hand. Arkadley risked a glance upwards, and made frantic eyebrow movements at Rincewind, who even at the best of times wasn't much good at interpreting non-verbal communication. This wasn't the best of times.
"With a sock," said Coyne. "What good... is a sock?"
The arm holding the staff rose. Coyne looked down at it in mild astonishment.
"No, stop," he said. "I want to talk to this man."
He stared at Rincewind, who was swaying back and forth under the influence of sleeplessness, horror, and the after-effects of an adrenaline overdose.
"Is it magical?" he said curiously. "Perhaps it is the sock of an arch-chancellor, a sock of force."
Rincewind focused on it. "I don't think so," he said. "I think I bought it in a shop or something. I've got another one somewhere."
"But in the end it has something heavy?"
Yes, said Rincewind. He added, "It's a half brick."
"But it has great power."
Well, you can hold things up with it. If you had another one, you'd have a brick."
Rincewind spoke slowly. He was assimilating the situation by a kind of awful osmosis, and watching the staff turn ominously in the boy's hand.
"So, it is a brick of ordinariness within a sock, the whole becoming a weapon."
Yes.
"How does it work?"
You swing it, and then you hit something with it, or sometimes the back of your hand. Sometimes.
"And then perhaps it destroys a whole city?" said Coyne.
Rincewind stared into Coyne's golden eyes and then at his sock. He'd pulled it on and off several times a year for years. It had darns he'd grown to know and love. Well, no. Some of them had whole families of darns on their own. There were a number of descriptions that could have applied to the sock, but Slayer of Cities wasn't among them. "Not really," he said at last. "It sort of kills people, but leaves buildings standing." Rincewind's mind was operating at the speed of continental drift. Parts of it were telling him that he was confronting the sorcerer, but they were in direct conflict with other parts. Rincewind had heard quite a lot about the power of the sorcerer, the staff of the sorcerer, the wickedness of the sorcerer, and so on. The only thing no one had mentioned was the age of the sorcerer. He glanced towards the staff. "And what does that do?" he said slowly. And the staff said, "You must kill this man." The wizards, who had been cautiously struggling upright, flung themselves flat again. The voice of the hat had been bad enough, but the voice of the staff was metallic and precise. It didn't sound as though it was offering advice, but simply stating the way the future had to be. It sounded quite impossible to ignore. Coyne half raised his arm and hesitated. "Why?" he said.
"You do not disobey me."
"You don't have to," said Rincewind hurriedly. "It's only a thing."
"I do not see why I should hurt him," said Coyne. "He looks so harmless, like an angry rabbit."
"He defies us."
"Not me," said Rincewind, thrusting the arm with the sock behind his back and trying to ignore the bit about the rabbit.
"Why should I do everything you tell me?" said Coyne to the staff. "I always do everything you tell me, and it doesn't help people at all."
"People must fear you. Have I taught you nothing?"
"But he looks so funny. He's got a sock," said Coyne.
He screamed, and his arm jerked oddly. Rincewind's hair stood on end.
"You will do as you are commanded."
"I won't.
You know what happens to boys who are bad?"
There was a crackle and a smell of scorched flesh. Coyne dropped to his knees.
"Here, hang on a minute," Rincewind began.
Coyne opened his eyes. They were gold still, but flecked with brown. Rincewind swung his sock around in a wide humming arc that connected with the staff halfway along its length. There was a brief explosion of brick dust and burnt wool, and the staff spun out of the boy's hand. Wizards scattered as it tumbled end over end across the floor. It reached the parapet, bounced upwards, and shot over the edge. But instead of falling, it steadied itself in the air, spun in its own length, and sped back again, trailing octarine sparks and making a noise like a buzzsaw. Rincewind pushed the stunned boy behind him, threw away the ravaged sock, and whipped his hat off, flailing wildly as the staff bored towards him. It caught him on the side of the head, delivering a shock that almost welded his teeth together and toppled him like a thin and ragged tree. The staff turned again in mid-air, glowing red-hot now, and swept back for another and quite definitely final run. Rincewind struggled up on his elbows and watched in horrified fascination as it swooped through the chilly air, which for some reason he didn't understand, seemed to be full of snowflakes, and became tinged with purple, blotched with blue. Time slowed and ground to a halt like an underworld phonograph. Rincewind looked up at the tall, black figure that had appeared a few feet away. It was, of course, Death. He turned his glowing eye sockets towards Rincewind and said in a voice like the collapse of undersea chasms,
"Good afternoon."
He turned away as if he had completed all necessary business for the time being, stared at the horizon for a while, and started to tap one foot idly. It sounded like a bag full of maracas. Said Rincewind. Death appeared to remember him.
"I'm sorry,"
he said politely.
"I always wondered how it was going to be," said Rincewind.
Death took an hourglass out from the mysterious folds of his ebon robes and peered at it.
"Did you?"
he said vaguely.
"I suppose I can't complain," said Rincewind virtuously. "I've had a good life. Well, quite good."
He hesitated.
"Well, not all that good, I suppose. Most people would call it pretty awful."
He considered it further.
"I would," he added, half to himself. "What are you talking about, man?"
Rincewind was nonplussed.
"Don't you make an appearance when a wizard is about to die?"
"Of course, and I must say you people are giving me a busy day."
"How do you manage to be in so many places at the same time?"
"Good organization."
Time returned. The staff, which had been hanging in the air a few feet away from Rincewind, started to scream forward again. And there was a metallic thud as Coyne caught it one-handedly in mid-flight. The staff uttered a noise like 1,000 fingernails dragging across glass. It thrashed wildly up and down, flailing at the arm that held it, and bloomed into an evil green flame along its entire length.
"So, at the last, you fail me!"
Coyne groaned, but held on as the metal under his fingertips went red, then white. He thrust the arm out in front of him, and the force streaming from the staff roared past him and drew sparks from his hair and whipped his robe up into weird and unpleasant shapes. He screamed and whirled the staff around and smashed it on the parapet, leaving a long, bubbling line in the stone. Then he threw it away. It clattered against the stones and rolled to a halt, wizards scattering out of its path. Coyne sagged to his knees, shaking.
"I don't like killing people," he said. "I'm sure it can't be right."
"Hold on to that thought," said Rincewind fervently.
"What happens to people after they're dead?"
said Coyne. Rincewind glanced up at Death.
"I think this one's for you," he said.
"He cannot see or hear me," said Death, "until he wants to."
There was a little clinking noise. The staff was rolling back towards Coyne, who looked down at it in horror.
"Pick me up."
"You don't have to," said Rincewind again.
"You cannot resist me. You cannot defeat yourself,"
said the staff. Coyne reached out very slowly and picked it up. Rincewind glanced at his sock. It was a stub of burnt wool, its brief career as a weapon of war having sent it beyond the help of any darning needle.
"Now kill him."
Rincewind held his breath. The watching wizards held their breath. Even Death, who had nothing to hold but his scythe, held it tensely.
"No,"
said Coyne.
"You know what happens to boys who are bad?"
Rincewind saw the sorcerer's face go pale. The staff's voice changed. Now it wheedled.
"Without me, who would there be to tell you what to do?" "That is true," said Coyne slowly. "See what you have achieved."
Coyne stared slowly round the frightened faces.
"I am seeing," he said. "I taught you everything I know."
"I'm thinking," said Coyne, "that you do not know enough."
"Ingrate! Who gave you your destiny?"
"You did," said the boy. He raised his head.
"I realized that I was wrong," he added quietly. "Good! I did not throw you far enough!"
Coyne got to his feet in one movement and swung the staff over his head. He stood still as a statue, his hand lost in a ball of light that was the colour of molten copper. It turned green, ascended through the shades of blue, hovered in the violet, and then seared into pure octarine. Rincewind shaded his eyes against the glare and saw Coyne's hand, still whole, still gripping tight, with beads of molten metal glittering between his fingers. He slithered away and bumped into Harkardly. The old wizard was standing like a statue with his mouth open.
"What'll happen?"
said Rincewind.
"He'll never beat it," said Harkardly hoarsely. "It's his. It's as strong as him. He's got the power, but it knows how to channel it."
"You mean they'll cancel each other out?"
"Hopefully."
The battle was hidden in its own infernal glow. Then the floor began to tremble.
"They're drawing on everything magical,"
said Harkardly. "We'd better leave the tower."
"Why?"
"I imagine it will vanish soon enough."
And indeed the white flagstones around the glow looked as though they were unravelling and disappearing into it. Rincewind hesitated.
"Aren't we going to help him?" he said.
Harkardly stared at him, and then at the iridescent tableau. His mouth opened and shut once or twice.
"I'm sorry," he said.
"Yes, but just a bit of help on his side. You've seen what the thing is like."
"I'm sorry."
"He helped you."
Rincewind turned on the other wizards who were scurrying away.
"All of you. He gave you what you wanted, didn't he?"
"We may never forgive him," said Harkardly.
Rincewind groaned.
"What will be left when it's all over?" he said. "What will be left?"
Harkardly looked down.
"I'm sorry," he repeated.
The octarine light had grown brighter and was beginning to turn black around the edge. It wasn't the black that is merely the opposite of light, though. It was the grainy, shifting blackness that glows beyond the glare and has no business in any decent reality. And it buzzed. Rincewind did a little dance of uncertainty as his feet, legs, instincts, and incredibly well-developed sense of self-preservation overloaded his nervous system to the point where, just as it was on the point of fusing, his conscience finally got its way. He leapt into the fire and reached the staff. The wizards fled. Several of them levitated down from the tower. They were a lot more perspicacious than those that used the stairs, because about 30 seconds later the tower vanished. The snow continued to fall around a column of blackness which buzzed. and the surviving wizards who dared to look back saw, tumbling slowly down the sky, a small object trailing flames behind it. It crashed into the cobbles, where it smouldered for a bit before the thickening snow put it out. Pretty soon it became just a small mound. A little while later a squat figure swung itself around the courtyard on its knuckles, scrabbled in the snow, and hauled the thing out. It was, or rather it had been, a hat. Life had not been kind to it. A large part of the wide brim had been burned off. The point was entirely gone, and the tarnished silver letters were almost unreadable. Some of them had been torn off in any case. Those that were left spelled out W-I-Z-D. The librarian turned around slowly. He was entirely alone, except for the towering column of burning blackness and the steadily falling flakes. The ravaged campus was empty. There were a few other pointy hats that had been trampled by terrified feet, and no other sign that people had been there. All the wizards were wazards.
What's that?
Wasn't there... Pestilence groped for his glass. Something...
What's that?
We ought to be... There's something we ought to be doing,
said Famine.
Yes, right. Got an appointment.
Pestilence gazed reflectively into his drink.
Thingy.
They stared gloomily at the bar counter. The innkeeper had long ago fled. There were several bottles still unopened.
Okra, said Famine eventually. That was it. No.
The apostrophe,
said War vaguely. They shook their heads. There was a lengthy pause.
"'What does apocrustic mean?'
said Pestilence, gazing intently into some inner world.
"'Astringent,' said War, I think.
"'It's not that, then.' "'Shouldn't think so,'
said Famine glumly. There was another long, embarrassed silence.
"'Better have another drink,'
said War, pulling himself together.
"'Yes, right.'
About 50 miles away and several thousand feet up, Canina at last managed to control her stolen horse and brought it to a gentle trot on the empty air, displaying some of the most determined nonchalance the disc had ever seen. "'Snow?' she said. Clouds were roaring soundlessly from the direction of the hub. They were fat and heavy and shouldn't be moving so fast.' Blizzards trailed beneath them, covering the landscape like a sheet. It didn't look like the kind of snow that whispers down gently in the pit of the night, and in the morning turns the landscape into a glittering wonderland of uncommon and ethereal beauty. It looked like the kind of snow that intends to make the world as bloody cold as possible.
"'Bit late in the year,' said Nigel.
He glanced downwards, and then immediately closed his eyes. Creosote watched in delighted astonishment.
"'Is that how it happens?' he said. "'I've only heard about it in stories. "'I thought it sprouted out of the ground somehow, "'bit like mushrooms, I thought.'
"'Those clouds aren't right,' said Canina.
"'Do you mind if we go down now?' said Nigel, weakly. "'Somehow it didn't look so bad when we were moving.'
Canina ignored this. "'Try the lamp,' she commanded. "'I want to know about this.' Nigel fumbled in his pack and produced the lamp. The voice of the genie sounded rather tinny and far off, and said,
"'If you would care to relax a little, trying to connect you.'
There then followed some tinkly little music, the kind that perhaps a Swiss chalet would make if you could play it, before a trapdoor outlined itself in the air, and the genie himself appeared. He looked around him, and then at them.
"'Oh, wow!'
he said. "'Something's happening to the weather,' said Canina. "'Why?'
"'You mean you don't know?' said the genie.
"'We're asking you, aren't we?'
"'Well, I'm no judge, but it rather looks like the apocalypse, yeah?"
"What?" The genie shrugged. "The gods have vanished, okay?" he said. "And according to, you know, legend, that means..."
"The ice giants," said Nigel in a horrified whisper.
"Speak up,"
said Creosote.
"The ice giants," Nigel repeated loudly, with a trace of irritation. "The gods keep them imprisoned, see, at the hub. But at the end of the world, they'll break free at last and ride out on their dreadful glaciers and regain their ancient domination, crushing out the flames of civilization until the world lies naked and frozen under the terrible cold stars, until time itself freezes over, or something like that, apparently."
"'But it isn't time for the apocalypse,' said Canina desperately. "'I mean, a dreadful ruler has to arise. "'There must be a terrible war. "'The four dreadful horsemen have to ride, "'and then the dungeon dimensions will break into the world.' "'She stopped, her face nearly as white as the snow.
"'Being buried under a 1,000-foot ice sheet sounds awfully like it anyway,' said the genie.
"'He reached forward and snatched his lamp out of Nigel's hands.
"'Mucho apologies,' he said. "'But it's time to liquidise my assets in this reality. "'See you around, or something.'
"'He vanished up to the waist, and then with a faint last cry of, "'Shame about lunch!' disappeared entirely. "'The three riders peered through the veils of driving snow towards the hub.
"'It may be my imagination,' said Creosote, "'but can either of you hear a sort of creaking and groaning?'
"'Shut up,' said Canina distractedly.
"'Creosote leaned over and patted her head.'
"'Cheer up,' he said. "'It's not the end of the world.'
"'He thought about this statement for a bit and then added,
"'Sorry, just a figure of speech.'
"'What are we going to do?' she wailed. "'Nigel drew himself up.
"'I think,' he said, "'that we should go and explain.'
"'They turned towards him with the kind of expression "'normally reserved for messiahs or extreme idiots.
"'Yes,' he said, with a shade more confidence, "'we should explain.'
"'Explain to the ice giants,' said Canina.
"'Yes.'
"'Sorry,' said Canina. "'Have I got this right? "'You think we should go and find the terrifying ice giants "'and sort of tell them that there are a lot of warm people out here "'who would rather they didn't sweep across the world "'crushing everyone under mountains of ice? "'And could they sort of reconsider things? "'Is that what you think we should do?'
"'Yes, that's right. "'You've got it exactly.'
Canina and Creosote exchanged glances. Nigel remained sitting proudly in the saddle, a faint smile on his face.
"'Is your geese giving you trouble?'
said the Serif.
"'Geese,'
said Nigel calmly. "'It's not giving me trouble. It's just that I must do something brave before I die.'
"'That's it, though,' said Creosote. "'That's the whole rather sad point. You'll do something brave, and then you'll die.'
"'What alternative have we got?'
said Nigel. They considered this.
"'I don't think I'm much good at explaining,' said Canina in a small voice.
"'I am,' said Nigel firmly. "'I'm always having to explain.' The scattered particles of what had been Rincewind's mind pulled themselves together and drifted up through the layers of dark unconsciousness like a 3-day corpse rising to the surface. It probed its most recent memories in much the same way that one might scratch a fresh scab. He could recall something about a staff, and a pain so intense that it appeared to insert a chisel between every cell in his body and hammer on it repeatedly. He remembered the staff fleeing, dragging him after it, and then there had been that dreadful bit where death had appeared and reached past him, and the staff had twisted and become suddenly alive, and death had said, "Ipslaw the Red, I have you now." And now there was this. By the feel of it, Rincewind was lying on sand. It was very cold. He took the risk of seeing something horrible and opened his eyes. The first thing he saw was his left arm, and surprisingly, his hand. It was its normal grubby self. He had expected to see a stump. It seemed to be night time. The beach, or whatever it was, stretched on towards a line of distant low mountains under a night sky frosted with a million white stars. A little closer to him, there was a rough line in the silvery sand. He lifted his head slightly and saw the scatter of molten droplets. They were octoron, a metal so intrinsically magical that no forge on the disk could even warm it up.
"Oh," he said, "we won then."
He flopped down again. After a while, his right hand came up automatically and patted the top of his head. Then it patted the sides of his head. Then it began to grope with increasing urgency in the sand around him. Eventually it must have communicated its concern to the rest of Rincewind, because he pulled himself upright and said, "Oh, bugger!" There seemed to be no hat anywhere, but he could see a small white shape lying very still in the sand a little way away, and further off, a column of daylight. It hummed and swayed in the air, a three-dimensional hole into somewhere else. Occasional flurries of snow blew out of it. He could see skewed images in the light that might be buildings or landscapes warped by the weird curvature. But he couldn't see them very clearly because of the tall, brooding shadows that surrounded it. The human mind is an astonishing thing. It can operate on several layers at once. And in fact, while Rincewind had been wasting his intellect in groaning and looking for his hat, an inner part of his brain had been observing, assessing, analysing, and comparing. Now it crept up to his cerebellum, tapped it on the shoulder, thrust a message into its hand, and ran for it. The message ran something like this. I hope I find me well. The last trial of magic has been too much for the tortured fabric of reality. It has opened a hole. I am in the dungeon dimensions, and the things in front of me are the things. It has been nice knowing me. The particular thing nearest Rincewind was at least 20 feet high. It looked like a dead horse that had been dug up after 3 months, and then introduced to a range of new experiences, at least one of which had included an octopus. It hadn't noticed Rincewind. It was too busy concentrating on the light. Rincewind crawled back to the still body of Coin and nudged it gently.
Are you alive? He said. If you're not, I'd prefer it if you didn't answer.
Coin rolled over and stared up at him with puzzled eyes. After a while, he said,
I remember...
Best not to, said Rincewind.
The boy's hand groped vaguely in the sand beside him.
It isn't here any more, said Rincewind quietly. The hand stopped its searching.
Rincewind helped Coin to sit up. He looked blankly at the cold silver sand, then at the sky, then at the distant things, and then at Rincewind.
I don't know what to do, he said.
No harm in that. I've never known what to do, said Rincewind with hollow cheerfulness. Been completely at a loss my whole life.
He hesitated.
Oh, I think it's called being human or something.
But I've always known what to do.
Rincewind opened his mouth to say that he'd seen some of it, but changed his mind. Instead, he said,
Chin up. Look on the bright side. It could be worse.
Coin took another look around.
In what respect, exactly?
He said, his voice a shade more normal.
What is this place?
It's a sort of other dimension. The magic broke through and we went with it, I think.
And those things?
They regarded the things.
I think they're, things. They're trying to get back through the hole, said Rincewind. It isn't easy. Energy levels or something. I remember we had a lecture on them once.
Coin nodded and reached out a thin, pale hand towards Rincewind's forehead.
Do you mind? He began.
Rincewind shuddered at the touch.
Mind what? He said.
If I have a look in your head.
Brr!
It's rather a mess in here. No wonder you can't find things.
Brr!
You ought to have a clear-out.
Ah!
Rincewind felt the presence retreat. Coin frowned.
We can't let them get through, he announced. They have horrible powers. They're trying to will the hole bigger. They can do it. They've been waiting to break into our world for...
He frowned.
Eons.
Eons, said Rincewind.
Coin opened his other hand, which had been tightly clenched, and showed Rincewind the small grey pearl.
You know what this is, he said.
No, what is it?
I can't remember, but we should put it back.
Okay, just use sorcery. Blow them to bits and let's go home.
No, they live on magic. It'd only make them worse. I can't use magic.
Are you sure? Said Rincewind.
I'm afraid your memory was very clear on the subject.
Then what shall we do?
I don't know.
Rincewind thought about this and then, with an air of finality, started to take off his last sock.
No half bricks, he said, to no one in particular. Have to use sand.
You're going to attack them with a sock full of sand?
No, I'm going to run away from them. The sock full of sand is for when they follow.
People were returning to Al-Khali, where the ruined tower was a smoking heap of stones. A few brave souls turned their attention to the wreckage, on the basis that there might be survivors who could be rescued or looted, or both. And among the rubble, the following conversation might have been heard.
There's something moving under here.
Under what? By the two beards of M'tal, you are mishearing. It must weigh a ton.
Over here, brothers!
And then sounds of much heaving would have been heard, and then...
It's a box. It could be treasure, do you think? It's growing legs by the 7 moons of Nazarim.
5 moons!
Where did it go? Where did it go?
Never mind about that. It's not important. Let's get this straight. According to the legend, it was 5 moons.
In Klatch, they take their mythology seriously. It's only real life they don't believe.